Afternoon. Welcome to this session. And we're delighted that you have to have you all here. This is a session on breaking down the walls of stigma and silence, mental health in the Orthodox community. We're delighted to have two very capable presenters in this. I just want to mention by way of introduction, firstly, Mincha will be at 12:30. Don't forget that. Secondly, one of the easiest ways to break down walls is to realize that depression, for example, has been with us longer than we think. If you take a look in Bereshit, where it says by HaKadosh Baruch Hu, when he saw what he had created, Vayitatzev el libo, which one of the commentaries says, Vayitatzev is the opposite of simcha. Now you may say, what's the opposite of simcha? Usually the opposite of simcha is depression. So if God could be depressed, then we can all be depressed too. And the second, of course, is in this week's Torah reading, where after the flood, Noah planted a vine and he got drunk. The question is, why did he purposely plant in order to purposely get drunk? And the answer is, maybe, that he was also depressed about what happened. There are certain things in life that make you lose your mind, unless otherwise you have none to lose, is what has been said by some famous observer of the scene. So, just with that in mind, I take great pleasure in presenting two very interesting individuals. We'll begin with the good rabbi, Rabbi Nathaniel Helfgott, who is a Magidshir and director of Tanakh and Jewish thought departments at Chovevei Torah. It's a new and interesting Jewish institution in New York. Teaches at Mayanot and the Drisha Institute, involved with the Orthodox Forum. He's on the board of Har Etzion, amongst others, and the Association of Modern Orthodox Day Schools. He is the editor of Letters of the Rav Zatzal, which, has it come out yet? Coming up soon? March or April? Can we put in a reserve bid for a copy? Essays of Rav Aaron Lichtenstein, his Rebbe, and a sefer that is available up here of Chidushim, that's in memory of your father. My great pleasure to present Rabbi Helfgott, who has written a tremendous article on this in a relatively recent issue of Jewish Action, which has caused a great stir in Orthodox circles. Rabbi Helfgott.
Thank you very much. It's a pleasure to be back here in Toronto. I was here, I think, a year ago, speaking from this two years ago at the Rabbi Kelman Shul, and it's a pleasure to be with you this morning. In 1996, I took a sabbatical. I had been teaching about 10 years in yeshiva day schools and high schools. I was a very successful teacher. Not here to toot my own horn, but I was, but it's important for the story. I had won awards from the Educators Council of America, and I took a sabbatical. I won a Jerusalem Fellows, and I went to Israel. I had a tremendous year in Israel, and I came back and helped found a school in Teaneck called Mayanot Yeshiva High School, which was a school for a modern Orthodox, intense school for Yeshiva High School girls. Right after Sukkot, all of a sudden, I wasn't able to sleep. I wasn't able to... Things started to feel wrong. All of a sudden, after about 4 or 5 days, I lost my appetite. I lost about 15, 20 pounds in the course of 2-3 weeks. I started to feel extremely tense and nervous. I couldn't concentrate. I started to feel like I had to stop working. I couldn't function. I had been an extremely successful teacher, and all of a sudden, my world was coming apart around me. The open house of the school was taking place a few weeks after Sukkot, and that day, everything came to a head. I called a very dear friend of mine, who was also a psychologist, and asked him if he could pick me up right after the open house. And we spoke for about 2 hours. And he said to me that what you have is clearly major depression, clinical depression. And immediately I went, it was in Teaneck, I went that afternoon to see a psychiatrist who was somebody who I knew as well, who prescribed for me medication of anti-anxiety medicine, which let me sleep for the first time in 2 weeks, and got me into therapy. And eventually I was able, through therapy and medication, to get my depression under control, to the point where I was back within about 4 or 5 months back to normal, quote unquote, back to where I was. And it was an amazing experience because the depression gave me an opportunity of going to the therapy that helped me understand myself much better. Eventually, it allowed me to meet, to understand myself to the point where I could get married. I have two beautiful children and another one on the way. And at the same time, during the course of my depression, and I had two other very serious bouts of depression a year later and another year later, and the reason that I had them was because I stopped taking the medication. People are very afraid, for some reason, of taking medication. We've grown up in a culture where somehow people who really need medication are afraid to take it and talk about it, and all these terrible stigmas, which is ridiculous, just like people take diabetes medicine, they take insulin or other medicine. My father took medicine for blood pressure for 20 years. He never felt stigma about it. And in fact, I have a friend who was the president of a shul and the president of his and of a day school, who also had major depression a number of years ago. And he says, you know, if he would, he would like to make a bracha every morning on the Prozac and the Effexor and whatever that he takes every morning, because it lets him function totally normally. To the point where it was during the course of the experience. So I took medication for 6 months, and then with the advice of the doctor, when you first have it, so you try to wean off of it. A year later, same experience. Same thing, and then a year later, wean off of it, same thing. And then after that, decided that there's no reason to stop, because obviously I have a propensity for that. Whether, and again, I'm not a psychologist or a psychiatrist, but I can discuss the exact relationship between nurture and nature. I believe that it's both. I believe that the chemical issue in the body, together with the experiences that one has in life, are interactive, and they're not always sad experiences. My very good friend, who was the president of his shul and the president of his day school, who had depression, he went into his major depressive episode right after the bar mitzvah of his oldest child. It wasn't that he had broken up with somebody or had a divorce or anything like that. That's why, in fact, the term depression, I think, is a terrible term, that it's misused. And that's why I love Rabbi Volker, but I take issue with the little vignette and little Dvar Torah that you started with, because I think it is really not appropriate, in the sense that people say, oh, I broke up with my girlfriend, I'm depressed. Or I went, you know, I lost money in the stock market, I'm sad, I'm depressed. To talk about that in the same sentence as clinical depression or bipolar depression or any other of the mental illnesses is really a disservice. Clinical depression is not something that you can go to a movie or go out to a bar and cheer up from. Just like you wouldn't go to a diabetic or someone with a heart disease and say, oh, just pull yourself up by your bootstraps and you can get out of a clinical depression. The term depression medically is talking about people like myself who have had serious, you know, again, I'm not here to, you can go through all the different indices in the diagnostic manual of having 5 indications of this or 9 indications of that over two weeks or 3 months. But it's a serious disease that affects us, but thank God can be treated. But what we all have to do, and different treatments exist for mild depression. Some people find that cognitive therapy can help them, and other people find that in mild depression, different kinds of therapy can help them. For more serious depressions, I think that the combination of therapy and medication is what seems to be working for many, many people. And in extreme situations, even what's called electric therapy, which, you know, has this nightmarish scene around it from 30 or 40 years ago, but it's not true anymore. It's much more targeted, it's much more focused, and it's much more effective. This is a terrible, terrible reality that we need to confront. And the reason I wrote this article in Jewish Action, right, in 2000, in the fall 2001, issue, is because as I was going through depression and I was starting to talk to friends, and I had wonderful friends who didn't say silly or stupid things like, oh, just pull yourself out from your bootstraps, or just get over it, or it's just in your head, or whatever that means, or things of that nature, but really were empathetic and supportive and helpful, and didn't simply, you know, God forbid, to talk about it. What I found was, as I started to talk to people, there were lots of people who had depression, whether it was unipolar depression, the kind that I had, or bipolar depression, manic, what used to be called manic depressive, or other mental illnesses, issues. And they're all obviously different. This is what's called the type of thing that I had. It's called a mood disorder, as opposed to the more serious mental illnesses that, you know, that like from the movie A Beautiful Mind, schizophrenia and stuff like that, which is a much more serious issue, and we know much less about it and how to treat it. But what I found was, oh yeah, a good friend of mine said, yeah, when I was in high school, I had this. And then I found, oh yeah, my mother had this for 20 years. My grandfather had this. But all of a sudden, everybody had it. Or everybody knew somebody in the family who had it, or a girlfriend, or a boyfriend, or a long-lost cousin, but no one was talking about it. And I met people who weren't getting help. I met people who were afraid to go. And this is really criminal, in my opinion. I'm sorry, I'm using harsh words. But I met people who would not send their children or their teenagers to therapy because they were afraid for the shiduchim, not of the kid, but of the sister who was of marriageable age. So you sacrifice, God forbid, a child or the life of a person who could be helped very quickly, probably, in many, many situations. Not all depressions can be helped, but could certainly be a functioning member of society and certainly be alive, mamish, pikuach nefesh, dinei nefashot, and would be sacrificed from some sort of ridiculous stigma that we as community all buy into and we need to fight and destroy. And then a very dear friend of mine who had very serious medical problems as well as depression committed suicide. And I also heard of a student of mine who had very serious bipolar depression, who committed suicide. And I said, this is enough. We have to start writing and we have to start talking about this. And so about 2 years ago, I wrote the article in Jewish Action. And what was amazing was, and this bothered me, so to speak, a little bit, but I understood it, but that itself was the reason I needed to write the article. Everybody came over to me after I wrote the article and said, you were so courageous. Well, courageous, courageous. I just talked. I wrote an article about what happened to me. Nothing courageous. I didn't do anything courageous. I, thank God, had good friends and good family who helped me, direct me. I didn't make any stupid decisions. And I went and I got therapy and I went to the doctor. Just as if I had cancer or if I had diabetes or if I had high blood pressure or if I had whatever disease, I went and I tried to get help and that's it. And I take my Paxil regularly. There's nothing to be afraid of. And I take it, I brought it, show and tell. It's a little pill that just affects the serotonin neurotransmitters in the brain. And there's nothing to be afraid of. And we should all, again, we can make a bruch on it, whatever, like my friend said. And thank God, since I've been, thank God, I went back to teaching after 4 months. I got married in the interim. I had 2 kids. I've been editing books. I'm the editor of many things. I'm involved in many projects. And I'm very normal. What all these, and we need to destroy, that's what I say, these stigmas. We need to destroy the stigmas in every single thing. Every single person in this room, not just nodding when I'm talking, but needs to go out, be energized when they go out of this room about when they're going to talk to coworkers, when they're going to talk to family, when they're going to talk and break down these stigmas. Every person, if you buy into it, if you play the game with the shiduchim and with not talking about it, at one time, as I understand, people, I didn't grow up in this world, but people tell me that at one time people didn't say the word cancer. You would say cancer, like that, right? Or things like that. And that kind of thing hurts people. We cannot continue doing this. We cannot be as life was. There are too many people. The statistics, I was talking to someone before, the statistics say that, at least in the United States, I don't know, I assume it's similar here in Canada, statistics say that about 20% of the adult population will sometime experience a depressive episode sometime in their life. Women have a higher percentage because of the postpartum and premenopausal and postmenopausal issues that affect hormones and the chemicals, etc., and life stresses. And the reality is, That means about a quarter of people will experience in the United States population. Amongst Jewish men, it's a little bit higher even than that. It's not 20%, it's about 26%. That's what the statistics say. And what's even scarier in certain ways is too many people don't get help. Only about 5 to 8% are properly being treated in the United States. Thank God it's getting more people are talking about it, it's become a more open discussion, but even there we still have, unfortunately, too many of the insurance companies don't provide enough reimbursement for going to therapy. They go, you know, you can go to therapy for 5 times to get reimbursed. What does 5 times do? You just get to know your therapist. 5 times doesn't do anything. But together we can do small things that will help break down the stigmas. This is, you know, basically the story that I wanted to tell you, but I really, you know, again, when we use the term mental health and mental illness, it covers a wide swath of illnesses. Dr. Malin will speak much more in terms of the clinical and what's going on in the Orthodox community. But that's the message that I wanted to give. I want to let Dr. Malamud speak first, and I'm going to, at the end, I'll take some questions, etc., and speak a little greater about some of the things. Dr. Malamud.
Thank you very much, Rabbi Helfgott. We can't let Dr. Malamud up without being properly introduced. So my pleasure to introduce you to her. Soon to be Dr. Malamud. She holds a master's in psychology from the University of Toronto, currently completing a doctoral degree from the U of T. She has been in therapeutic practice for 5 years, 18, she's been treating children, adolescents, and adults, worked at the Clark Institute of Psychiatry, Credit Valley Hospital, and Hinks Delcrest Center, and has maintained a private practice for the past 9 years. And as Rabbi Helfgott indicated, she's going to give us an overview of what's going on out there. My pleasure to present Leah Malamud.
Before beginning, I just wanted to say amen to what Rabbi Helfgott had to say. Amazing Yavin. Okay. A woman spends 1 to 2 hours nightly saying Tehillim, feeling something bad will happen if she doesn't complete a certain number. She also feels compelled to kiss all the mezuzahs in her house every day upon leaving and upon returning, sometimes even exiting and immediately returning, thinking she might have missed some. A man in his mid-30s takes approximately 1.5 hours every morning to daven, a half hour of which is spent adjusting his tefillin to make sure that they're placed precisely on his head and arm. If he did not check and recheck, he feels guilty all day. He's frequently late to the office due to this practice and has been recently passed up for promotion because of these frequent latenesses and general preoccupation. An earnest yeshiva bachur in his late teens finds himself spacing out during learning and is very troubled by his Bittelsmann, but he doesn't feel he's able to control it. He's become depressed due to feelings of helplessness and inadequacy. He also refuses to accept money for long hours of tutoring of others in Torah learning, feeling it is mixing, this is his phrase, mixing materialistic needs with spiritual duty, though his financial situation is extremely desperate. A brilliant Talmudic scholar insists that two of his children, both under five, collect the remaining breadcrumbs from Kiddush to prevent Baal Tashchis, he says, and then he instructs them to cross a busy street on their own to distribute the breadcrumbs to the birds while he stays in the Beis Medrash and learns so there won't be Bittul Torah. A young married woman consistently ends up regularly postponing her monthly visit to the mikveh due to a compulsion to keep checking and rechecking the toilet and her underwear for possible signs of still being in nida. And finally, an Orthodox teenager gets angry at her mother for making fried food. She eats little and disappears quickly into her room after supper, claiming lots of homework, spends a lot of time in the bathroom. The girl refuses a ride to and from school, even though it is a 45-minute walk back and forth, even in bitter cold weather. Now, the first obvious point. The Orthodox community is no more immune to the plethora of psychological disorders than is the rest of the population, Jewish or otherwise. There is depression, obsessive-compulsive disorder, eating disorders, physical and sexual abuse, substance abuse, personality disorders, suicide, and so on and so on. And clearly, some of these details of mental health issues described in Jewish Orthodox patients are universally shared by all populations. But there are unique aspects that are specific to the Orthodox patient, as well as unique conditions which accompany him entering therapy. And these are what I'd like to focus on today. My comments are based on my own 18 years of experience treating Jews across the spectrum, from religiously right-wing to completely secular and also non-Jews, adults as well as children and adolescents, and based also on verbal and written reporting from other Orthodox therapists in the areas of psychiatry, psychology, social work. I'll be touching on some of these unique aspects, describing them and offering some case examples. However, given the time constraints, this is not a comprehensive treatment of the topic. My intention here is simply to highlight various issues unique to Orthodoxy and mental health. The religious identity of a patient often raises special issues in the course of treatment. As well, there are special challenges which face that patient's therapist. Sorry, I just need some water. Okay. I'm going to focus on four issues. One, the different expressions of what has been referred to as religious resistances to treatment. Two, thanks. Distinguishing between healthy versus neurotic religiosity or piety versus pathology. Three, the types of conflicts which arise in the form, the religious symptoms, through which these conflicts or disorders manifest themselves, that is, religious manifestations of pathology. And four, the interface between individual predisposition and Jewish religious law and culture in the development of pathology. That is, how the structure of Jewish religious life may, albeit unwittingly, contribute to the development of pathology in one who is psychologically vulnerable to such a disorder. Okay, to begin. Sorry, before beginning. Before continuing, however, it's important to note that as one who strongly affiliates and identifies with the Orthodox Jewish world and appreciates its truth and beauty, including the wisdom of its intensive structure and detail, it should be clear that I'm not blaming Orthodox practice for psychological pathology. However, the interaction between religion on the one side and those who are vulnerable to the development of pathology on the other, must be understood so that we are able, as professionals and as lay people in our respective communities, to be vigilant regarding both prevention and treatment of mental health concerns in the Orthodox Jewish community. I'll begin, then, by discussing religious resistances, two in particular. Okay, the first one is the patient's direct or indirect appeals to religion, to religious dogma. Now, religious patients express a variety of responses to a religious therapist. On the one hand, the feeling of familiarity lent an initial sense of rapport, which helped somewhat to ease the anxiety about starting therapy, a feeling particularly difficult for some members of the Orthodox community for a variety of reasons. Sometimes, however, there will either be a direct appeal to or a confrontation with the mutual and normal religious beliefs and practices shared by both patients and therapists in order to draw some implicit pact of non-challenge from the therapist regarding certain topics. Thus, subtle references to the commonality in our lifestyles may be made. Or, on the other hand, which expresses just the other side of the same anxiety-based coin, references to religion may be avoided. Both approaches can be attributed to a wariness regarding the therapist's particular form of orthodoxy in fear of possible therapist disagreement with their view, and a need to be either self-reassuring or avoidant of potential conflict, respectively. Attitudes of particularly the avoidant sort, however, also often betray a particular defensive style on the part of the patient. That is, the avoidance may possibly represent an unconscious attempt to alert the therapist, in this case me, to areas which are either taboo or psychologically threatening and conflictual for the patient. On a conscious level, however, these avoided issues are often rationalized under the guise of religious dissimilarities or religious law. So I'll give you some examples of patient comments. It would be a waste of time to discuss my childhood. I am ultimately responsible for my actions, so what need is there to discuss my parents? People say these things. I don't feel it's appropriate to talk about how that conversation with my mother made me feel. That would be rushing her. Or a variation on this. How could I be angry at my mother? She gave me life. What does it matter how I felt? What they said was right. We can't talk about that usually sexual thoughts and feelings. It's not snua. Or, you know that there are specific halachot about talking about those matters, and since you understand basically what I'm talking about, I don't need to say anything else. You just need to know that I'm upset. Why do the details matter? And from an anorexic patient who felt powerless, how can I think about disagreeing with my parents? It's against kibud av va'em. Also, conversely, patients' religious questions and difficulties purposely get raised to avoid discussion of the deeper psychological conflicts and to ward off intense pain and anxiety through focusing on less threatening areas of conflict. So let's talk about Shabbos so we don't have to talk about how I feel about my mother, right? The patient's appeal to religious dogma, for instance, the Lashon Hara, the Tznius justifications, are defensive shields against the free association process in therapy, a process which, when not blocked, would perhaps in turn bring the patient to conscious awareness and thoughts and feelings with which she had been in conflict and had heretofore been suppressing. This is precisely how normative religious beliefs get appropriated, co-opted, in Israeli psychologist Moshe Spiro's term, in the service of the persons, the egos, need to preserve whatever psychological conflict is operating, because that conflict does have some kind of a function. And to at least initially oppose the development of an alliance with a therapist in order to protect from experiencing different feelings. Okay, let's assume that the matter of the halachic position on various normal religious restrictions within a therapy context has been discussed. For instance, that talking about various feelings and relationships in therapy is not considered lashon hara, which it isn't, from a halachic point of view, and then in fact, from a religious perspective, the patient's current so-called religious position with respect to what can be said in therapy actually impedes his personal religious goals. To illustrate, let's say that the patient's self-proclaimed goal is to achieve a state of mind and heart which permits unfettered use of their God-given self and talents in the service of God, a non-anxious, non-depressed self with intimate, loving relationships and behaviors which are felt to be freely chosen rather than compelled or acted out. This is opposed to the way they currently experience themselves and their lives. Then if, in the face of the halachic clarification just described, there is subsequent continuing of resistance to acknowledgement or exploration of various difficulties, thoughts, and feelings, this patient behavior essentially exposes the apparently religious resistance of, it's a halacha, so I can't discuss this, as a straw argument. Lashon Hara is an example of a typical religious restriction in normal circumstances. However, when it is used in the psychotherapeutic context, it is a defense against confronting one's feelings regarding other people, in particular hostility, rage, sometimes sadness. Beyond discussions like this, however, which address necessarily some of the fundamental structures and tools of psychotherapy, the therapist should not, as a rule, be getting into religious debates with the patient about the patient's religious interpretations and beliefs versus that of the therapist. This allows the patient to misuse the therapy via distraction with halakhic content discussion without addressing the underlying psychological conflicts that these topics may evoke or represent to the patient. I'll be returning to this point shortly. What is important to address is, firstly, the transferential need of the patient to experience the therapist as a representative of or a detractor from religious authority. When I say transference, I'm speaking of the patient's need to view the therapist as a substitute figure for other people in her life, whom the patient experienced as figures of authority or nurturance. The therapist becomes the person onto whom many of her unresolved feelings and expectations regarding the original figures gets transferred, old religious issues as well as old emotional conflicts. These are transferred onto the therapist. These transferred feelings are crucial to deal with, need to be explored, because it is a key path to all the issues of importance. Secondly, there is the importance of exploring the patient's disowned conflicts and ambivalence about both religious issues and psychological issues, the latter of which may also be represented, at least on a conscious level, by religious issues. For example, when a patient of mine continued to push the issue of what I thought with respect to certain kinds of sexual behaviors or bad thoughts about God, it was then important for me not to answer the question, but to explore with her, rather than responding directly, what kind of answers she imagined getting, including both her hopes and her fears, and how she felt about these fantasied answers she'd come up with. This kind of questioning led her to discover and eventually consciously own, as part of herself, the complexity of her own desires, passions, and feelings, not just with respect to sex or God, but regarding all of the people and issues these areas had come to represent for her. In fact, the whole issue of feelings, awareness, and denial thereof is in itself a large facet of the problem. I will address this briefly later in cultural contributions. Then there is the religious resistance, which one might call the "my worldview is on trial" conflict. Resistance that expresses itself in a general ambivalence about the whole business of being in therapy, due to its being sourced and thought in what is thought of as secular knowledge and chachmas hagoyim. The resistance looks like this. The patient comes to therapy and may even tell you how highly recommended you were as a therapist by their doctor and even by their rabbi. But then they will proceed to tell you about how this probably won't help. In the end, if they get better, it will only be because of God. Then ask questions about the therapist's belief with respect to biological versus psychological basis of people's problems, e.g. homosexuality, being reluctant in the early history gathering to talk much about their family backgrounds, particularly if there might be an intimation of something less than optimal having occurred in their childhood, comment repeatedly on therapy as the other approach, that is, as opposed to relying solely on Torah and Torah authorities. I'm speaking of the situation where the Torah versus the secular world conflict facilitates and, in fact, represents a split-off model, a model which, in dichotomizing between two areas of knowledge and then degrading one of them, represents one's own disowned feelings, desires, and passions, which have not yet been properly acknowledged and integrated. The patient is, so to speak, saying, one way of disowning the part of me that I'm not comfortable with, whatever desires and passions that I have, which may feel psychologically threatening to be aware of, like anger at parents, I attribute to the influence of the modern world, with therapy as the biggest culprit. Chachmas Hagoyim, in other words, becomes the convenient receptacle for all my feelings that I would like to attribute to the other, to solve the ambivalences that I am not comfortable with experiencing. Rather than incorporating them as different aspects of me that I acknowledge and then decide how and if I would like to express or channel these various parts of me, I split off the parts that I feel ashamed of or threatened by, and I externalize them. The bottom line conflict for these people is the following. What am I doing here? Not only in the sense that the non-religious person asks it when coming into therapy, that is, how did my life get to the point where I need therapy, etc., but rather in the Ben Bogvog sense. Recall that Ben Bogvog was the rabbi in Pirkei Avot who said with respect to the Torah, turn it over and turn it over, because everything is contained within it. These people are trying then, whether consciously or unconsciously, to grapple with the question of, doesn't Torah have all the answers to every situation, including mental health problems? Then why am I still suffering so much, so unhappy? There must be some flaw in me, because it certainly can't be that the Torah is missing anything. There's a resultant sense of shame about needing or choosing to seek psychotherapy and about the implied ambivalence as to whether or not Torah really does have all the answers. The shame and ambivalence then has an effect, at least initially, on their ability to allow themselves to utilize the tools of psychotherapy towards greater mental health. I'm now going to try to unpack the very complex issue of piety versus pathology. That is the difference between healthy and neurotic religiosity. Moshe Spiro, who's written extensively on the subject, emphasizes, and I quote, "It is crucial to recall that the patient's religious beliefs and activities are relevant to the therapist only insofar as they cause or are involved in conflict for the patient, that is, causing distress within themselves or their relationships." And further, says Spiro, "Elements of religion are neurotic only to the degree that such disorder is characteristic of total functioning, predominates, or is autonomous of more mature elements." In other words, does the patient's thinking or behavior interfere with his normal functioning to the point where his other life priorities or schedule demands or needs of others are compromised due to mental and time preoccupation? Does the behavior appear driven? That is, if I don't do it, is there subjective distress unless it is somehow released? And do I feel that my need for immediate and full gratification of my instincts and desires via this, either exaggerated or regressive, religious release is stronger than the regulatory balance implied within normal mitzvah observance? Ultimately, is the behavior more autonomous, literally self-ruling, within the person's control, or disautonomous? Seems to have taken over the person and therefore deemed pathological. And ironically, does the religious behavior actually interfere with the person's functioning to the point where his overall religious goals are actually being compromised due to a fixation on one particular religious thought or activity? So when individuals have co-opted religiousness in the service of their psychological disturbances and it has become a dominant part of their personalities or their preoccupation, then it is clinically appropriate, advised in fact, to address the issue with the patient. But what if there is a double layer? That is, what if there are aspects of the presented religious difficulties which are in fact authentically religious dilemmas overlaid on the psychological issues that are being masked? As well, external symptoms can be indicative of a variety of underlying issues. That is, similar religious beliefs in two different people may respectively be expressing very different psychological conflicts. In the final analysis, I'm not there to debate religion with the patient, nor is my role to make moral pronouncements. Doing these, in fact, will only obscure and suffocate the issues that need to be addressed. I am there to help the patient uncover and sort out his psychological conflicts, which may or may not be manifested in his religious conflicts, so that he may then use his energies to live without debilitating symptoms. Okay, let's distinguish between immature religiosity and mature religiosity. On the one hand, immature religiosity would be when a person is using religion in the reductionistic fashion by which Freud describes all of religion. That is, using God or religion as an expression of and a container for infantile dependency wishes and anxieties, love and fear, which were originally experienced in relation to the parent, which then allows the person to escape responsibility from his or her own life, really from a serious engagement with reality, because God or religion is taking care of everything for me. Mature religiosity, on the other hand, would be when a person engages in religion as a way of deepening his appreciation of God's world, of reality, so that his mental state and activities are then infused with the desire for personal creative growth and creation of a life of meaning, all ultimately motivated by his desire to know God and God's ways better. This, in contrast to the other, is about a pursuit of responsibility and engagement with reality. It is about moving from discipline to devotion. This last point highlights the fact that just because religious or moral conflicts are frequently sourced in deeper, more general psychological conflicts, it does not mean that the converse is true. That is, that religious values therefore contain the causes of neurotic conflict. A patient's unconscious may use, so to speak, his religious beliefs as the mode of expressing his larger group of psychological conflicts, of which for him religion is one. However, this does not mean that religious values are carriers, so to speak, of neurosis. In fact, as we experience as religious Jews and as supported by psychological research, religious values and morals, those not distorted by psychic conflict, actually promote a significant sense of well-being and have a positive impact on mental health, personality structure, interpersonal relationships, and so on, and in turn, even on physical health. I would now like to focus on the issue of psychological disorders as they're clinically manifested specifically within religious rituals or contexts. As I illustrated in the various brief clinical descriptions with which I began my talk today, often, though not always, pathology is expressed via the religious rituals and contexts of the person's life as an observant Jew. These religious expressions of pathology appear to be for three reasons. Firstly, because people naturally express their emotional issues within the context of the culture and behaviors of the world they live in. Secondly, because the nature of the conflicts with which a person might be wrestling might relate back to primary issues like relationship with authority, for which religious or God rituals would be natural vehicles through which to act out these conflicts. And thirdly, because the inherent structure of the religious world, in particular, that of the Jewish religious world, due to its emphasis on detailed ritual structure and on the rational over the emotional, unwittingly encourages certain types of behavior in those who are constitutionally vulnerable or predisposed to particular kinds of thinking or behavior, so that the person is merely exaggerating now what he's already doing. I'll address this issue in greater detail before concluding. Thus, albeit unwittingly, and certainly not inevitably, it may be often through religious ritual that the unhealthy manifestations of that behavior, the pathology, ends up being expressed. This is where one gets into the area of trying to clinically distinguish between piety and pathology, or religiousness from religiosis. An example is the case described earlier of compulsive mezuzah kissing and tehillim saying. This woman's mother had died when she was a teenager. She eventually acknowledged in therapy that even prior, she had felt neglected by a mother very preoccupied with numerous siblings and a stressful marriage. Although her mother had been referred to by many others as a tzaddikus, and the daughter was well aware of her mother's many positive attributes, this woman felt that her mother's difficulty in saying no to outsiders seeking her help, her difficulty with communicating clear and prioritized boundaries, as well as her difficulty hearing anything negative about her children's teachers due to Lashon Hara and Kavod HaTorah, had resulted in my patient and her siblings feeling, ironically, deprived of emotional validation and support. This woman's neurotic behavior expressed simultaneously and paradoxically her intense denial of anger at her dead mother for abandoning her in life and in death, yet in the same gesture, also her intense yearning to be protected by mother and God. And then there is the example of the young man who refused payment for Torah tutoring, protesting that the two were a spiritual contradiction, and who also learned intensively, reviewing compulsively, but was constantly spacing out and felt anxious and depressed when learning. In therapy, this man eventually realized that his moral high road or purity position with respect to taking payment for teaching simultaneously represented the following. On the one hand, an internalization of the lack of received nurturance from his parents, as expressed in the feeling of not deserving receiving anything indicating his value, like monetary payment, as well as a disavowed passive-aggressive expression of anger towards his parents. This disavowed anger was manifested both in a compensatory overexpression of religiosity, known as a reaction formation, which I will explain in a moment, and as well internalized in the form of anger towards himself expressed in his poverty position. In these cases, the pathology may be finding expression, even need to be expressed, in a religious form for at least two reasons. Reasons which appear contradictory, but for which both may be true simultaneously for a particular individual. Let us say, as in the examples just given, that there is a feeling of disconnection in relationship from a significant figure in one's life, often from parents or from God. There is a deep feeling of emptiness, and an obsession develops around what is missing, a key aspect around what one feels powerless about. In a religious ritual, even to the point of neurotic and dysfunctional excess, may represent the desperate seeking of more connection. Alternatively, however, the intensification of religious ritual can also represent what is referred to in the psychoanalytic literature as a reaction formation, an unconscious defense mechanism that allows both suppression and discharge of all the denied feelings of anger and sadness regarding, for instance, disconnection and loss, but in a psychologically ingenious way. The person behaves in a way that outwardly proclaims the exact opposite of what is actually felt. That is, she or he demonstrates a strong feeling of connection. I feel disconnected, and I'm going to show you how connected I feel. This unconsciously motivated behavior keeps the unwanted feelings disowned, unacknowledged, and at bay. A line from Shakespeare comes to mind when I see such a patient with extreme, compulsively ritualized behavior. Methinks the lady doth protest too much. This is the nature of a reaction formation. One paradoxically intensifies the connection in order to deny disconnection. In these cases, via compulsive religious or ritualistic behavior. Thus, feelings of emptiness and feelings of anger, while representing two very different impulses or needs, can still end up being expressed through the same neurotic behavior. The problem, of course, is that the apparent solution doesn't work, not emotionally and not religiously. The extreme neurotic behaviors are not experienced as satisfying because the actual feelings feeding these behaviors, the underlying desire for connection, to be seen, and associated emotions, is not being spoken of and expressed directly. There are leaks which manifest in various forms. Anxiety about needing to maintain the compulsive behavior or else guilt will descend. In depression, in increased feelings of being controlled by these compulsions. Compulsions originally designed to control troubling and oppressive obsessions by keeping them out of consciousness or at least at bay, but now, ironically, experience as controlling one's life. As well, when people feel driven to certain behaviors and experience all kinds of negative feelings associated with either the doing or not doing of these behaviors, and when the original feelings driven underground are looking for expression, there is a subsequent feeling, an increasing encroachment of dysfunction in many areas of one's life. Interference with daily routine, personal and work relationships. It was only after these people had acknowledged and processed their repressed anger, sadness, sense of betrayal, and abandonment at lack of nurturance and recognition, and then mourned and let go of what was not, that they were able to self-nurture and cultivate, enable self-recognition via direct assertion of their feelings and rights. The woman who kissed mezuzahs and could not sleep without her requisite tehillim quota could now kiss, so to speak, or engage in real intimacy with her children and her husband, and with God as well, without fear of triggering painful and unresolved feelings related to childhood deprivation. The man who refused teaching payment and was depressed due to his inability to concentrate on his learning and associated feelings of inadequacy was subsequently energized by a newfound deep sense of self-esteem, dignity in his sense of himself as a transmitter of Torah, an authentic feeling of connection to God, rather than by a compensatory and superficial piety accompanied by depression. It is extremely noteworthy that the concern that getting in touch with one's feelings may threaten to subvert the religious agenda actually, in reality, appears to go the other way. That is, whereas prior, that which was disavowed resulted in what I would call a more fragile piety, in that it was being fueled by fear of self-knowledge and fragmentation of the self, and a subsequent buffering against these via a sort of compensatory kind of religiousness, now, via what the Sixth Lubavitcher Rebbe described as a personal kibbutz galuyot, an ingathering of split-off parts of oneself, there is an ability to live fully, expressing an authentic and grounded spirituality and religious observance. In the words of David HaMelech, Baruch Nafshi Et Hashem V'chol Kravai Hashem Kadsho, my soul will bless God, all my innards, his holy name. I now come to a fourth aspect of mental health difficulties, which I introduced earlier, which is unique to the Jewish Orthodox world. The structure of the Jewish religious world encourages certain types of behavior, as well as emphasizes certain types of personality, aspects of personality over others. For instance, there are very circumscribed and detailed ritualistic observance and behavior, requiring a great deal of scrupulous attention to detail, repetitions of behavior several times a day, attentiveness to time and behavior at various times, davening, bracha, kashrut, nida, shabbos, chagim. A very ordered, structured, patterned life, which despite the built-in room for personal self-expression and the ultimate spiritual goal of the halachic structure of the mitzvot, paradoxically being that which will actually enable the person's existential liberation, is still, on the surface, very rigid and defined. The earlier described examples of obsessive-compulsive disorder as manifested in religious rituals is only one illustration of the interface between how the highly structured, detailed mores of a Jewish Orthodox world can be very challenging to maintain in healthy balance for those who are naturally predisposed to obsessive-compulsive disorder. A 1994 clinical study in Israel confirmed that in the context of religious tradition that is particularly demanding about ritualistic exactness, OCD symptomatology is common and frequently includes religious content. And the fact that there is currently an Orthodox mental health referral service based in New York, which receives a very high volume of calls with respect to OCD, suggests that the combination of culture with predisposition can precipitate symptoms that might otherwise not get expressed. However, as stated in the outset, and when discussing piety versus pathology, I'm obviously not suggesting that religious practice causes neurosis. There are many people, for instance, who may have had repressed feelings about painful experiences, and also many who keep an Orthodox lifestyle, but clearly not everybody develops OCD. And in general, it has been observed by researchers Delaney and Fisk in a comparison of 20 different cultures that there is a universal inborn psychological mechanism for ritual, and that for most people, ritual is the way people healthfully structure their lives. Through behavioral symbols, they express meaning, mark time and life events, transitions, and cope with misfortune. It is clear, however, that for those who are vulnerable, the lines between fervent religiosity and pathology can get quite blurred. The initial brief description of my compulsive tefillin adjuster and need to check our patients are cases in point. This observed interface between certain characteristics of Orthodox communities and certain psychological vulnerabilities is also applicable to the current alarming proliferation of female adolescents with eating disorders in the Orthodox world. One 1997 study in New York by Dr. Ira Sacker, a leading expert in eating disorders with a major focus in the Orthodox, both Litvish and Hasidic, and Syrian Jewish communities in Brooklyn, found, this is the statistic, one out of 19 girls was suffering from an eating disorder, a rate 50% higher than the general population. It also revealed that almost two-thirds of Orthodox girls are at risk in light of their attitudes about food, appearance, feelings about growing up, etc. Sacker points out that a traditional Jewish upbringing, with all its halachic and communal expectations and guidelines, provides very few opportunities for personal choice and self-expression, one of the strong psychological contributors to the development of an eating disorder. In my own practice, this issue is echoed repeatedly, although there is certainly a complexity of contributors to the development of an eating disorder, and this is not the only reason. One aspect unique to the Orthodox world, which appears to be playing an influential role, is the fact that the girls with indications of eating disorder as early as pre-adolescence are reacting to a life which feels very dictated and controlled in every way. More so, the more you move more to the right, from the time they are very young. Mitzvah observance, chesed involvement, hair, tied back, not down, clothes, ideas, questions, speech, friends, approximate marriage age, who you're going to marry, children. It leaves them feeling that there is no arena in which they can exercise autonomy. Their bodies become the only places where they can assert power and self. One girl said, I feel like I'm going from my parents' house and rules to what will then be my husband's house and rules after finishing high school and seminary, and then become a baby-making machine. This is a particular comment, but it's not an unusual comment. Added to whatever other vulnerability factors the girls individually possess, the current disturbing emphasis in the Orthodox world on external appearance, and particularly on super thinness as a drawing card in the world of shidduchim, creates a very at-risk ground for a girl with predisposing vulnerabilities for developing an eating disorder. And of course, the difficulty is only further exacerbated by the stigma for some against seeking therapy, again because of the shidduch concern, which is, of course, a vicious circle. It only exacerbates the existing problem by creating more shame and more isolation and not addressing the original problem. The other issue, which appears to be the unwitting outgrowth of certain religious and cultural emphases, is the de-emphasis on feelings awareness and the often associated denial of feelings. There's a tendency in a community so highly regulated by rules and doing what's right, not what you feel, to become less conscious of what one is actually feeling before going ahead to do the right thing. At times, this is more overt, and at times, it's more meta-communicated. As well, it is a text-based culture, greatly valuing the discipline of rigorous, rational analysis in learning and in character building. Particularly in the Litvish world, there's been less of an emphasis placed on spiritual self-development and more on the development of intellectual prowess and volume of knowledge, as well as an imbalance overall between external, public behavior in the form of chumras and the internal or spiritual development. Emphasis on greater feelings awareness does not mean that one should always be acting on one's desires. However, for feelings to be channeled and regulated appropriately and in healthy ways and not instead expressed through, for example, eating disorders or aggression, substance abuse or obsessive compulsive disorder, panic attacks or depression, there has to be a forum starting from a very young age, both within families and within schools, to evoke, welcome, discuss, and validate the various feelings that children and adolescents actually have, and not just the nice feelings, so they do not defend against the anticipated non-acceptance and non-validation by having these feelings be suppressed, that is, go underground, only to resurface in the form of uncontrolled pathology. Our communities have to take a lot more responsibility for this on every level. So in closing, how then can the therapist deal with the complexity of religious issues that presents? Ultimately, the challenge for the therapist is to address the emotionally based neurotic issues which may be communicated to one's therapist and to oneself in the context of religious concerns while still maintaining the integrity of the patient's religious life and values. This is, of course, assumes that the therapist's awareness of his or her own countertransference feelings with respect to the religiosity of the patient. The Midrash explains, with respect to a passage in Devarim which speaks of the return of a lost object, that the commandment can be broadened to include the idea of self-restoration. You must also restore him if he himself is lost. The Rambam in Perush HaMishnayot explains this idea with reference to general medical intervention. The idea of being returned to oneself can be extended to the psychotherapeutic endeavor, to the restoration of the patient's psychic self, so that he or she may be free to serve God in a whole way with all aspects of his or her being.
So before Mincha, if you want to ask a question, please go to the mic. We'll put this mic over here and you'll share it.
Many people, the stigma of mental illness, and I think that every community needs to deal with it. But in dealing with the Orthodox community, you talk a lot, Dr. Malamut, about psychotherapy and what my question is that as a primary care physician, a lot of my patients can't afford psychotherapy. And from just teachings, I think a lot of it is biological. Nurtured does play a role, but how do I, as a primary care physician, deal with it more on a now basis, not so much going back into their past from other parents or, because a lot of time I don't necessarily believe it's only that. Okay. How do we deal with in the now? What kind of therapy can we do for today rather than dealing with their past?
Although I'm not one who is looking to push medication if it's not necessary, I also am not inclined to say don't use it. If it's needed, it's needed. Sometimes it's needed on a temporary basis in order to get to the point where you can actually either find a therapist or feel good enough to actually utilize therapy. There also is Rabbi Helfgott alluded to a reciprocal interaction between the emotional issues and the physical. Sometimes in the biological, the chemical side of it. What I mean to say is that there are people who, although they do not have biologically based depression, they have emotionally based depression, and that there are certain issues, say, that have contributed in their childhood or to whatever they're feeling. When a person is depressed, there are actually chemical changes in the brain which can respond to medication, which is why medication still works with people even in biologically based depression as a primary source. So, on one foot to say how to deal, it's a problem in Canada because basically it gets split between those who are on OFIP, i.e. the psychiatrists, the psychiatrists and those who are not, the psychologists and social workers, and often it is actually the psychologists and social workers who have had far more training in talk therapy. The psychiatrists have not, which is not, a psychiatrist bashing. It's just the way the educational system is. And as you point out, people don't have the funds to go into therapy for long periods of time. I can't solve the social medicine issues in Canada. I can only state that it's a problem and that I agree with you. So as an initial stage to offer somebody medication, either to tide them over or in conjunction with, I would be supportive of that.
I just want to add that I also, as I mentioned in my remarks, that I believe in the interaction of medication and therapy, especially I know more about depression issues and bipolar, but it is important that it be monitored. I think it's very irresponsible for a primary care physician to dispense and then, disappear and not have the training, because different people need different calibration of the right dosage and you need specific training in that. And if people stop taking medication all of a sudden, and then there's rebound effects, and so it does need to be go hand in hand with a good monitoring of a therapist.
The topic was given as Greek Gavin Wall, silence of stigma and mental health issues in the Orthodox community. And I saw that your psychobabble did not help us in this situation at all. And I came here for the purpose of stating the case that there are many Jews in the community that cannot get married, cannot feel functional in the community, are not allowed to be purposeful and fulfill their fulfillment in the community because of the issues that they suffer from. And I don't see any help in that whatsoever by your talks. Your first speaker was quite eloquent, and but he seems to be successful in getting married, having two children, she emphasized. Yet there are people that cannot get married because of the very fact of a previous illness that they're going through. And I don't see how a psychobabble like you gave Miss future doctor, it helped the matter at all. I think you build up the wall rather than broke down the wall.
I'm sorry that evoked those feelings, but I think that I did try. Sorry? In any case, I was trying to address a number of issues, and I think that I did actually address the issue that you're speaking about that is a big problem in the community. I addressed the kinds of what I feel are the trends, the disturbing trends in the Orthodox community in general towards emphasis on external over internal in terms of not just physical appearance, but the imbalance between chumras versus spiritual development, and all of these have to do with the way people are perceived. If people are assessed according to their internal character or assessed according to their last name or their bank accounts or whatever other things that people are described by. I think I was trying to address that. If you felt it was not adequately addressed, I hope this further statement, makes that clear. The fact that the rabbis in the community don't speak about this enough, probably true. Can I talk about them as a group? No. There are definitely individuals who are very impressed with their proactivity, try to do whatever they can, will actively call people up about Shidduchim, they'll call me up to clarify certain things and so on to help change the way things are. But it's a very, very powerful thing. We're talking about a much larger issue, not just in Toronto, but everywhere in terms of what's happened to Orthodoxy. And I think it's beyond the forum of this particular, or the top of this particular forum.
Rabbi Helmut Scott explained to us how he and his society, through his own experiences, has helped break down the wall of silence and stigma in his society. And I would like, Leila, please, if you can, to give us a few suggestions how we can help in our community to break down the wall of stigma and silence, if you think it exists in our community, how we could best help to break that down.
Okay, I've just been instructed this is the last question, at least from the official. So if you can both comment and make that your concluding remarks, the afikoman with which they will be left.
So when I understand that I think it has to be changed within families and within schools, I think that from the very beginning, from when kids are very young, there have to be much more open discussion of feelings, processing of feelings, normalizing all kinds of issues that are basically not discussed.
But how are we going to get that out to our community? You're talking about the individual parents.
No, I'm talking about school. I don't run schools, but the school policy has to change in terms of what is considered taboo to discuss and what is not considered, and so on. I mean, all of it. Even being able to get into a school to talk about the proliferation of eating disorders is not a small matter. You know, the denial and the need to think there isn't such a problem, would be implied that there is if you let somebody in to speak about it. is a problem. So all of these things need to be addressed within the school system so that the kids are growing up with this as normal. This is not pathological to discuss feelings and variations on. And that just as Rabbi Helfgott was saying, people might have physical difficulties, there are emotional difficulties, and you deal with them however you deal with them, but it does not stigmatize you as a person or as a potential shidduch possibility.
Thank you. I would add, I think a very practical suggestion is to organize a conference here in Toronto, and this is what I did after I wrote the article. You have a conference, and the major part of it, besides educate, I called it a day of education and empathy. First of all, a very simple half-an-hour presentation just on the symptoms and information about the major mood disorders and mental illness issues so that people are aware of what it is and not be afraid of it, number one. Number two, to have speakers from the Orthodox community, like myself, but from Toronto, who are willing to talk about their own experience with depression, bipolar, schizophrenia, whatever it is, and prominent people who are in the community who are willing to talk about their experience. And that will start to break down the stigmas. Just like in the general society, when William Styron and Mike Wallace and other people and Tipper Gore, etc., talked about it and had these conferences, that it started to break down some of those stigmas in the society. We need to do more of that, and we need to push. Because I know that after I wrote my article, I must have gotten calls, and I still get, not as frequently, but I get at least once every 2 weeks, got a call from a rabbi, from an educator, from other people who've been going through either issues of depression, or their brother, or their sister, etc., and to talk about it. And that's, I think, a practical suggestion, to organize a day, and people give personal testimony about things, and what helped them, and what didn't help them, and different models, whether it's therapy, medication, electric convulsion, and to break down those stigmas. That's what will also help the shidduch issues. It's not just a question of success. There are different, quote-unquote, levels of success, and it's different, but the more we talk about this, as you just that you and I are all part of the same community, the more those things will break down.